Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a former Republican congressman from Illinois says there is a better way to do redistricting. He talks with us about a plan to change the system of redrawing political maps, but it will take voters in the state approving a constitutional amendment. President Trump has threatened to place troops on the streets of Chicago to deal with crime. We'll hear reaction to that idea and why some say it's illegal. Illinois lawmakers have pumped more money into the monetary award program to help low-income students attend college. We'll look at the changes that have been made. We'll also learn about the positives and the negatives of using AI in the court system, and why many women have difficulty communicating with their health care provider. We'll also track down the oldest book in a library and a visit to state fairs in the Midwest this summer. All ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. What does the law say about President Donald Trump's threats to send troops to the city of Chicago? The Chicago Sun-Times' John Seidel has been digging into whether doing that would be constitutional, and he put together a new analysis. He spoke with Mel Ballora.
John, you talked to legal experts about the possibility of troops being deployed to Chicago. Tell us, what was their take?
Generally, it can be summed up this way. You know, the idea of federalizing and sending National Guard troops into an American city is really something you do, what one person called a break glass in case of emergency moment, kind of a total breakdown of law and order. They're saying those conditions just don't exist on the ground in Chicago. One person suggested that's not even seriously in contention. And of course, there's crime. Nobody is denying that Chicago has struggled with crime, but it hasn't reached the kind of situation, it hasn't escalated to the point where it would be triggered under the law.
The National Guard was deployed to Los Angeles in June, and that prompted a lawsuit that's still being tried. Are there some legal lessons to draw from what happened in California?
Yeah. So in California, you know, a lot of people talk about whether or not President Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act. That's not what he did in California. He invoked a separate law that allows him to federalize National Guard troops if there's some kind of substantial impeding of the execution of federal laws. And the Trump administration has pointed to protests against ICE and immigration authorities that turned violent back in June. The case is still being litigated, but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals did have a chance to weigh in on this at one point. It found that the evidence of that violence means that the laws may have been impeded and that President Trump may actually have been acting within his authority. We'll see if there are further rulings, but I think that's an example of what we'd be watching for in Chicago. Is there a moment like that that the Trump administration might be able to point to? And the experts that I talk to say that they just don't see that on the ground right now.
John, your analysis does a great job of pointing out that the legal arguments here are really complex. The laws are really old, but the experts you talked to said this goes past technical legal questions, right?
Yeah, they all kind of took a moment to step back and caution against getting too bogged down in the statutes. The bottom line is, the way one person said it, this is just not how we do things in America. And it's some of our founding principles that we don't have the military enforce the law. This is just a concept that the country was built on.
I also wanted to ask you about other states sending their National Guard here. You talked to the experts about that question. What are they telling you?
Yeah, this was something, this kind of speculation is out there. And Governor Pritzker even mentioned it in his press conference earlier this week, this idea that one situation that could theoretically play out is that another state's governor, that might be sympathetic to President Trump, instead of having President Trump federalize their troops, that state's governor might send troops from their state here against the will of Governor Pritzker to assist with a federal mission being led by President Trump. And the experts, frankly, used pretty stark and disturbing terms to talk about what that means. One person said U.S. states do not invade each other. They used words like invasion, and they talked about how that's kind of, they didn't know what else to call that other than invasion or civil war when one state invades another. So I think a governor from another state could be crossing a very bright line if that happens. I think that's potentially a real flashpoint. And I think that's why Governor Pritzker mentioned it and called on his fellow governors to really think about what they might be doing in the coming days, weeks, and months.
John, thanks for looking into all the legal questions about all this.
Of course, glad to do it. Thank you.
That is John Seidel, federal courts reporter for the Sun-Times. People working to reduce violence in Chicago are decrying President Donald Trump's continuous threats to send the military to the city. Former Education Secretary Arne Duncan runs the anti-violence organization Chicago CRED. In an essay in the New York Times last week, Duncan wrote that the president is putting at risk years of hard work to bring down crime and restore trust in the police. Most recently, Trump called Chicago, quote, a killing field, and suggested he was willing to use active duty troops on city streets. Arne Duncan joins us now to talk about that. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Arne, what do you make of the president's comment that Chicago is a killing field?
First of all, it is hard. This is like an attempt for a massive distraction to the impact of tariffs, a massive distraction to the Epstein issues, massive distraction to reductions in Medicaid, elimination of health care. And Trump is a master of distraction. So that's what this is, a starting point. Secondly, you can't sugarcoat any of this. The overt racism is stunning. He's only looking at cities led by Black mayors. He would never, ever do this to a city with a white mayor. We know gun violence is actually highest in red states, but he would never do it there. And then finally, this is a major part of any authoritarian leader's playbook, is they want to desensitize the public, get the public used to having the military confront citizens, which is like almost unprecedented in our nation's history. So there's so much here at so many levels that's incredibly disturbing.
Data do show a significant decline in violent crime this year, and some Chicago officials have credited the work of violence interrupters with the declines that we're seeing. What does that work look like on the ground? You're involved in that.
Yeah, well, first of all, we're so proud, and I'll be very clear, this is not some mission accomplished moment. We have a long way to go, but I will say we have a chance to have the safest year in 60 years in Chicago in six decades. We're down about 40% this year. This will be the first time in 20 years that we will have four consecutive years of violence reductions. And so we are literally making history here. A long way to go, not satisfied yet, but just incredibly proud of the progress. And we just sort of believe a couple things. We believe you can't just arrest your way out of this problem. You got to give people off ramps to these cycles of violence that they're caught in often from a very early age. We believe that relationships change lives. So I wish there was some high-tech AI solution to what we do. Haven't quite discovered that. We're all about building relationships with those most at risk of shooting and being shot and helping them transform their lives. That's the joy of our work. We have a long way to go, but this is in our 9 years of doing this work, which is incredibly difficult and heartbreaking at times and dangerous. This is literally the best place by far that we've ever been. And I just it would break my heart if Trump somehow upends all the progress we've made.
So we can see by the numbers, crime is down, but there's no question there's still too much violence in the city of Chicago. What would you say to someone who says Chicago shouldn't turn down federal help to address crime problems?
Well, I'll just say a couple things. First of all, the National Guard, they don't go to the South and West Sides. They're not going to be in the neighborhoods. They're going to be downtown. They're going to be in those kind of places. That's what they've done in D.C. And let's be clear, Trump doesn't want peace. Trump wants conflict. That's what this is about. He wants a National Guard to shoot somebody. He wants someone to take a pot shot at a National Guardsman. He wants to, again, desensitize the public to the military, actively challenging the public. And so that's just a recipe for disaster.
Arne, thanks for talking to us about your essay on what will help Chicago.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
That's former Education Secretary Arne Duncan.
Melba Laura with that interview. The Illinois budget impasse began a decade ago. Lawmakers significantly cut funding for the state's Monetary Award Program, or MAP grants, for lower-income college students. Peter Medlin reports on how MAP has rebounded in the decades since.
I Northern Illinois University sophomore Michael Coker shows his friend around campus, posing for a picture in front of the Husky Pride sculpture during Welcome Week. His friend just transferred from community college, and Coker says if it wasn't for getting a MAP grant, he would have taken that same path.
Because then I could at least, you know, work my way through college. Because NIU is a little expensive, I mean, compared to Kish at least. But the MAP and FAFSA stuff really was a big decision in coming here.
He's not alone, and NIU Enrollment Administrator Sol Jensen says for many students, MAP doesn't just decide university versus community college.
If we did not have MAP grants, there are thousands of students that very likely would not be able to go to college.
And MAP funding has grown a lot since the budget crisis. In fiscal year 2016, the state appropriated $170 million for the program. In 2025, the state budget devoted over $700 million to MAP. And Jensen says that's been important, particularly at a school like NIU, where nearly half of the students receive MAP. He says the funding increases mean not only do more students receive financial aid, but the grant amounts themselves are larger. 8 years ago, the maximum MAP award at NIU was about $4,800 a year. And now it's over $8,000, so not quite doubled, but close. And he says to really understand what exactly that means for students, you have to put it within the context of the cost of tuition and fees.
Go back a decade, the MAP grant, at least at NIU, was covering about 38% of tuition and fees. Today, that is covering about 60%.
Jensen says another thing to note about MAP is that it's a first-come, first-served system. And during the budget impasse, funding just ran out quickly. So at NIU, it meant that around 10% of students who qualified for awards didn't get any.
But really now, when you look at the last 5 years, as the governor and the legislature has put more funding into the MAP grants, what we have seen is almost a one-to-one ratio, so that almost every single student that's eligible is also able to receive it.
This financial aid is also pivotal for many community college students. Patrick Pyre is the VP of Student Affairs at Rock Valley College, where over 1,400 students receive MAP grants. That's double of what it was during the impasse. And he says the average award amount those students receive has also nearly doubled. Their students are now receiving the most money they've ever gotten through MAP.
$500 in any given semester can make or break a student's ability to successfully complete a term and stay enrolled.
He says that's especially true for community college students who often choose to attend because they don't have a ton of money to spend on a university.
One of the main drivers of people who decide to attend and then take that break, whether it's a semester or 10 years, most oftentimes they're citing something to do with a financial shortfall.
The average family income of students receiving MAP is $33,000 a year, and more than half of eligible students have no extra money to pay for college. And despite those financial hurdles, a report from the Illinois Student Assistance Commission shows that MAP recipients graduate college at similar rates to all students at their institutions. And there are other forms of financial aid, like federal Pell Grants and merit scholarships, but at schools like NIU, the maximum MAP award is still larger than Pell and larger than any merit scholarships or other financial aid. Back at Rock Valley, Pyre says that the program, which was so unstable a decade ago, now provides much-needed stability. But with state and federal finances in flux, the question is if the increasing investment will continue. I'm Peter Mudlin.
State fairs are a riot of sights, sounds, and even smells. Each year as summer turns to fall, fairgoers take in livestock competitions, carnival rides, and lots of fried foods. Harvest Public Media spent time at three state fairs across the Midwest, including Illinois, to bring you this audio postcard.
I'm Sharon Rohenfeld from Mineola, Iowa, and I'm at the Iowa State Fair. We come every year to the Iowa State Fair, and we are here for approximately 2 to 2.5 days. We try to take in the entire fairgrounds. You know, you always have to try the new foods. This year they have 60-some new foods, so you got to try a few of those. You got to stay in line.
I'm Brad Blakeman at the Iowa State Fair.
I'm Amanda Hergard. We've come for the past 5 years together.
I've come for like the last 15 probably. I'm from Omaha, we both are actually.
It's tough to describe the butter cow.
When you tell people there's a butter cow, they have no idea how large it is or why people want to see it, but it's super iconic and it's our first stop every time we come. This is the first place we come. We bypass everything on the way here, food, drink, everything, to come here first.
In no particular order, the ones that are going to come back. Young lady in the purple stripes is going to go ahead and come back. Young lady here in the pink is going to go ahead.
Hi, I am Lacey Langmeyer, and we're at the Wisconsin State Fair, the Rabbit Barn. This is Tinkerbell. Tinkerbell is a Dutch. She's a golden Dutch. She's a senior doe. You have to work with your rabbits, even though they're a small critter. You have to like pose them, brush them, and clean them. And it just teaches you that they depend on you. So I think it went really good. It was definitely easier than I thought it was going to be.
Please put your hands together again for all those exhibitors. They all did an awesome job.
We'd like one cream puff, please. Yes,
please. Hi, I'm Mary Legg from the Wisconsin State Fair. Well, we're from Illinois, so we come up every year for the cream puffs. They are so creamy and delicious, and there's just not enough words to describe them.
All right, I do this very difficult circus trip. You guys go crazy and go grab a cream puff or something. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is David Turner. I have been coming to the Illinois State Fair for 4 or 5 years. I work for Vertical Amusements. I run the Walk on Water attraction. It's a fan favorite, a crowd pleaser, and we love it here. I hope to see everybody here. We'll be here to the end. I describe it as a bunch of kids being turned into human hamsters. Consists of getting inside of a 6-foot vinyl bubble on top of about 3 feet full of water. You do not get wet, you do not sink, and it's the Jesus experience. You walk on water.
My name is Leanne Hall. I've been coming to the Illinois State Fair for 38 years now. I am getting our Oxford sheep ready to go to the show ring here in this afternoon, probably about an hour or so. So these are trimming shears. They would have been what were used to get wool off of sheep before we had electricity and mechanical shears. This is Mike. Basically, I have a picture of the ideal sheep in my head, and I'm trying to get each sheep to look that way with what they have. So emphasize their best characteristics, try and hide their flaws, and get them as close to that ideal as that individual sheep can get.
It's Rachel Kramer in Iowa, Joe Schultz in Wisconsin, and Brian Mackey in Illinois, gathering audio for this postcard. Maria Altman helped with production. We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. As Western Illinois University enters its 126th year, President Christy Mindrup wants to focus on the institution's future instead of dwelling on the recent past. Rich Egger has more from Macomb.
During the annual University Assembly, President Christy Mindrup challenged the audience to look forward to what Western will become.
Are we ready to let go of what we were and to lift up where we are now in order to evolve into what we will be?
One change coming is a reorganization of Western's academic schools. Currently there are 4, but a year from now there will be just 2. There'll be the College of Humanities, Arts, Sciences, and Education, and the College of Business, Health, and Community Programs. University leaders say this will reduce administrative costs and encourage more interdisciplinary collaboration. Also during the assembly, administrators shared information about this fall's enrollment. The official figure won't be tallied up for another 10 days, but right now it appears to be around 5,100. Last fall, it was around 6,300. Mindrup says they were prepared for the decrease and made adjustments that will allow Western to be sustainable with a lower enrollment. She also says Western can be a great university even with 5,000 students.
We can leverage the idea of 5,000 students to ensure that students understand that they're not just a number at Western Illinois University, that they'll have personalized attention.
Mindrup also says Western is looking to expand and change some of its markets in order to attract new students. Mindrup says Western's enrollment has varied greatly through its more than century-long history. It started with just a couple hundred students. It peaked with more than 15,000 in 1973. Mindrup says no matter the number of students, the university has always fulfilled its mission of educating them. She says it's something Western will continue to do. Rich Egger reporting.
There's an effort to revive a push for a state constitutional amendment to make political redistricting less, well, political in Illinois. Former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and former Commerce Secretary Bill Daley have signed up to push for a referendum in November of next year. In 2016, the state Supreme Court ruled a similar Fair Maps amendment should not go on the ballot. In an interview with Charlie Schlinker, LaHood tells why this time could be different and the goal of the amendment.
You wouldn't have politicians picking their districts. If you look at state legislative districts, whether it's in the Peoria area or the Bloomington area, they're all carved up. My state rep, Ryan Spain, who was born and raised in Peoria, he works at OSF in Peoria. His father has a small business in Peoria. And in the last redistricting, he was completely drawn out of Peoria and moved north to Dixon and Princeton. And he's got a very good Republican district, but he's been separated from people that he grew up with, his neighbors, his friends. These districts are not compact and contiguous, which is what the Constitution calls for. They're gerrymandered districts drawn by politicians so they can pick their voters.
Are there examples of how such commissions actually have worked to even out the partisan tipping points?
The state of Iowa, the commission system works very well there. Common ordinary citizens, they draw the maps. And if you look at the map of Iowa, the districts are compact. Neighborhoods are not split up. Neighbors are not split up. Politicians are not disenfranchised and dislocated from their constituents that they've known all of their lives. To be honest, California has a very good commission system. Most of the politicians that I've ever talked to in the state believe it works very well.
Are the districts in California and Iowa notably less one-sided?
They reflect the fact that Democrats, Republicans, and independents are the ones that go to the polls and pick their representatives and senators, rather than just one party. It becomes untenable for people to run for office in the districts in Illinois. In the example that I used, the Ryan Spain district, no Democrat will ever beat him. And so the people, the Democrats, really have no opportunity to have a say in who the representative is other than a Republican.
How will this effort address the challenges raised in 2016 with the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, the decision, the opinion that was rendered said the reason it was struck down was because an outside individual, the Auditor General, would be a member of the commission rather than citizens. And the way we've addressed it, we will word the amendment so that there'll be 12 members. Three of the members, two of which will be citizens, one will be a legislator, will be recommended to the Secretary of State who will certify them. The point is common ordinary citizens, not politicians. Each leader, there's four leaders in the Illinois General Assembly, two in each house. They will have responsibility for recommending two citizens and one legislator. Those will be recommended and certified by the Secretary of State. They will become the 12-person commission. And the other thing that was not included is you cannot use political statistics, political data. You draw the maps to comport with cities and counties so that the political considerations, the political data, is not used as the criteria, but more the fact that they will be compact and contiguous and include entire cities and entire counties.
The proposal for the commission also focuses only on state legislative maps, not congressional maps. Why is that?
Constitution does not allow for a commission to draw congressional maps. If that were to happen, the legislature would have to pass, and they could, the legislature would have to pass a law that would allow for the drawing of congressional maps by a commission. That's not allowed now under the Constitution.
How does that, is there any prospect of change at the congressional level from a redistricting commission that operates at the General Assembly level?
If we have success with this type of commission at the next census, and that's when this would take place, this will be on the ballot in 2026, but it will not take effect until the next census. That's a few years away. If we have success, I'm sure there will be people that would like to see it done for congressional maps also.
There are mechanical and logistical hurdles, chief among them getting 328,000 signatures or more to avoid challenges.
The group that was involved in this in 2016 hired a firm to collect the signatures, far more than they needed, and that will be the case in this instance. We will raise some money. We will pay folks to help us collect the signatures. We will collect far more than the 365,000 that are needed, maybe more like 500,000 to make sure that we're able to withstand any kind of criticism or people that think that the signatures aren't legitimate.
The group that pushed this idea in 2016, Change Illinois, is doubting the process here. They're on record as saying that more input should have happened before you advance this from community organizations and community leaders. What's your thinking on that quibble?
Well, Charlie, we involved them. We sought them out. We had meetings with them. We told them what we were thinking, why we were thinking the way we were. We asked them for their support. At this point, they've chosen the idea that maybe we didn't incorporate everything that they wanted.
How much money is it going to take to educate the public once you get this on the ballot? Because it's Illinois is a big state.
Well, this is a campaign, Charlie. We will have to convince people that the commission is made up of citizens who will do what's right for the voters of Illinois in terms of drawing these maps. It'll take several million dollars, like it would any statewide campaign.
Having you, former Transportation Secretary, a Republican, and Bill Daley, former Commerce Secretary, a Democrat, at the top of the org chart makes it look like a bipartisan effort. How will you try to make that filter down to the rest of the effort?
Mayor Lightfoot, former mayor of Chicago, was at our meeting yesterday and spoke in support of it. We've reached out to other people that have been in politics and think that this good government opportunity will be appealing to people that have been involved in government or politics, and it's truly a bipartisan effort.
That's former Republican Congressman and Obama Administration Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. He spoke with Charlie Schlinker. Member station WBEZ produces a segment called Curious City, where listeners ask questions and reporters track down details. Aaron Allen brings us this edition that heads to the library.
The Chicago Public Library is over 150 years old, which means that some of the books in these branches are basically antiques. Last year, a bibliophile in Chicago stumbled upon a title that was well-worn, and it had that old book smell. This made him curious. How long can a CPL book live on the shelves? I'll let WBEZ's Stephen Arroyo take it from here.
Curious citizen Bradford Kasberg recently picked up a copy of Catherine Ann Porter's short story collection, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, from his beloved local Chicago Public Library, Sulzer Regional, in Lincoln Square.
And you could really tell that it was printed in the 60s. The binding, the yellowed pages made it look old, Everything about it. And my first thought when I grabbed it was, am I allowed to take this out of the library?
The worn binding, the brittle pages, they made Bradford curious. What is the oldest book in circulation within the Chicago Public Library system? So he put the question to the Ask a Librarian form on the CPL website and got a pretty quick response.
Hi, Bradford. I think the oldest book in circulation is called Life of James Crichton of Cluny. You can see it here in our catalog. It's from 1819. They added, I think that's a great Curious City question. If you ask them, maybe they'll find something even older.
Challenge accepted, Ask a Librarian. The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is an obscure title published in 1819 in Scotland. It's basically a biography of a Scottish polymath who perished under strange circumstances at age 21. I had to see if this book is, in fact, the oldest in circulation. So I headed to Harold Washington Library, and on the sixth floor, next to a memoir by Charlie Chaplin's son, was a hardcover book that I had no doubt was over 200 years old. I took it to the counter and was mildly shocked when they scanned the barcode and simply told me it was due back in 3 weeks. With an ancient secret in my backpack, I met up with Bradford at Sulzer Library. He had his doubts that you could even check this book out.
Are you serious?
This is it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
The edges of the pages are orange, kind of like a discolored orangish red. And the book binding itself is like a dark blue, slightly speckled, but overall in very good condition. It looks much newer than something I would have expected something from the late 1800s to look like.
The Life of James Crichton of Cluny was easy to check out, but confirming it was the oldest in circulation proved to be a bit more challenging. Sure, I could look in the library catalog and search by original publication date, but books are often reprinted and that information in the system can be spotty. I reached out to all 81 Chicago Public Library locations, and while I got a couple leads, I never did confirm an older book. So it seems Ask a Librarian was right. But how does such a book outlast the thousands of other titles on the shelves? Lindsay Laren with the Chicago Public Library suspects James Crichton flew under the radar just enough. It starts with what librarians call the book weeding process, to make space for books that are newer or more relevant to the community.
And we have 81 branches, and so each branch and each neighborhood has its own specific needs. And so weeding at CPL actually happens at the branch level.
She says book weeding can occasionally be controversial, especially when not done regularly. Sometimes weeding has been mistaken for censorship. The topic of weeding has even played a part in the recent discourse around book banning. Lindsay says CPL never throws books away. Weeded books go to a vendor for resale, and that money comes back to the library. And if they're too damaged for reuse, they're recycled. As for the Life of Crichton, Lindsay checked in with the Archives and Special Collections Division.
And they're like, you know, it doesn't look like this is something we would necessarily just add because it was old or even rare. I'm not sure it's technically rare. It is kind of a mystery to me, but, you know, if it's been checked out enough, if it's in fairly good condition, it just might not show up on anybody's lists or reports to look at for weeding. That's what I'm assuming happened, is that it just got kind of checked out enough.
In 1871, after the Great Chicago Fire, Queen Victoria donated a collection of books that became the bedrock of the Chicago Public Library's collection. Life of Crichton wasn't part of that, but there's a stamp inside the cover from 1892, which would mean that it entered the CPL collection just after the Queen's donation. So, all signs point to Life of Crichton being the oldest circulating CPL book, but how did the Ask a Librarian figure it out so quickly? Who is that person?
My name is Nick. I am a librarian at the Info Center at the Harold Washington Library Center in Chicago.
Nick is a real person, not a robot or some AI program. He was the Ask a Librarian who answered Bradford's original question. Nick went through date ranges, pulled some books, and through a process of elimination, he found Crichton.
It was kind of funny because, as far as I can tell, it's just kind of this weird book.
He says it's basically a self-published book, and it's not really worth anything.
Which is kind of good, because when I found it, I was worried, oh, you know, there's going to be this valuable book in the collection that someone, if they find out about it, they're just going to steal it. So it's kind of this perfect storm of, yeah, the oldest book in our collection that we can find isn't really that special.
He's right. I read through the book, and it's just okay. If you want to see the oldest book in circulation, The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is available for hold at Harold Washington Library.
Thank you to WBEZ Engagement producer Stephen Arroyo for reporting this story last year. As of this recording, The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is still in circulation. It's currently checked out, but you know, you can always get in line.
And thanks to member station WBEZ for that segment. You're listening to Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Maureen McKinney interviewed the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign Communications Professor Shari Thompson about a study looking into women's communication with healthcare providers. Thompson says her study shows that women often face difficulty expressing to doctors the existence and severity of medical conditions because of implicit bias.
I think the sort of performance of pain or expectations for how we talk about our pain when we visit medical professionals is very gendered. I mean, there's emotional elements, there's an expectation to be rational, so to just give the facts and to talk about it in sort of very measurable terms. But we know that there's a significant gender bias in medicine, and that there are false beliefs that women are sort of over-emotional and not rational, and that works against them sort of from the outset.
Is there a common denominator among women who find that they're not being taken seriously?
In the studies that I've done, I hesitate to say that there's anything else unilateral or common among every woman. So I can say though from research that I've done that there are characteristics or their identities or their health issues that tend to be more prominent. So for example, women tend to suffer more from health conditions that are not visible. So they're not readily apparent. Perhaps they're not measurable, like chronic pain or autoimmune diseases. There's no diagnostic testing for them. And so that uncertainty creates or is a knowledge gap where often physicians, I think, sometimes rely on heuristics that they have. And sometimes those heuristics are faulty or stereotypical. Again, I think for a lot of women, they have non-visible health conditions that are chronic. So they're not curable and they sort of last over time. They're not well understood by medicine. You know, I think it's important to also recognize that there's a difference between doubting a woman that she has pain. So that's sort of an existence thing. So you have pain, you don't have pain, or you have this issue, you don't have this issue. Women can be believed for something very visible or not visible, but someone may doubt or a health provider may doubt the severity. So they may say, oh, you can't be in that much pain, or it really can't be that bad. And so I think some women are just dismissed outright and they're like, that's not really happening. And some women may experience doubt of the sort of severity of what they're encountering.
What can women themselves do to make them feel credible to the healthcare provider?
It's very important to me to help equip women with the sort of communication tools or strategies to combat health dismissal, particularly in medicine. I can tell you what women say they do and what's often works for them, or at least provides them with the support in the moment. I can also share with you a kind of a subset of strategies that I would call more advocacy strategies that if women feel comfortable and have the resources that they can also engage. So a lot of women in the research I've done talk about how they always bring someone with them to medical appointments. The person is an advocate for them. They confirm their claims. They could talk to the doctor themselves. So they talk about bringing someone. They also talk about bringing evidence. If women feel like they're not going to be taken seriously just by their word, then they bring in evidence, whether it's existing medical records, maybe it's a diary of symptoms that they've kept, because such sort of evidence fits within a biomedical or a medical understanding of their symptoms and may be taken more seriously. And a lot of women don't outright challenge their doctor if they disagree, but they will face save by asking questions. So if a doctor recommends something or says something to them and they're not sure or they feel like they're being dismissed, they may say like, can you explain to me your clinical reasoning or why you think that? Or why would you recommend that? So it's more of like a and ask for information. A second set of strategies, I guess, is a little more on the advocacy side in terms of, is more explicitly about sort of pushing back. And so some women can disagree with their providers and say, you know, from the reading that I've done, I don't know if that's the best thing for me. Can we talk about alternatives? Women can explicitly state their needs and values, often from the outset of the appointment. This sets the tone for the appointment and lets the provider know up front, like, hey, this is what's important to me and what I want to keep in mind for the rest of our visit together. They also can ask doctors, kind of flip the perspective, and if they feel like the doctor's not taking them seriously, they can say, you know, my health is really important to me, and I'd really love to know, if you were in my position, what would you want to happen, or what would you recommend? And so that kind of, in some ways, forces the doctor to perspective take. And then finally, if doctors are not taking women seriously, switch doctors. If you can. I know that often it takes a long time to get into doctors, and health coverage doesn't sometimes allow for switching of doctors, at least easily. But if a doctor is not treating you well, switch doctors.
Is there a racial component or other demographic factors?
Yeah, absolutely. It's well documented. There's an intersectional component to women's health dismissal. So we know that there's a strong racial bias in medicine, particularly when it comes to pain. For example, studies document how Black people are thought to have thicker skin and feel less pain than white folks. More research, I think, is needed on other racial groups, but that is probably the most frequently mentioned research finding in terms of racial bias. But racial bias and gender bias intersect with other things like class and stereotypes that we all have, and doctors are not immune to this, about people who use social programs, or people who are drug seeking or med seeking, as they say. I think gender and race intersect with other both visible and non-visible markers of identity. Visible things might be like body size. So there's a pretty large literature talking about fat shaming in medicine, and how health issues, particularly for women, are often dismissed as sort of, you just need to lose weight. To more non-visible things, like perhaps non-visible disabilities, or health literacy and sexuality.
Is there anything I didn't ask you think we should talk about?
I guess I will leave by saying one of my goals as a researcher and a human in the world, and with the platform I have, is to help patients advocate for themselves and also help physicians be better communicators. I really want to bridge this chasm that is real and perceived between patients and providers, because providers want to help people and people want relief and help. And so my goal is not only to draw attention to bias and potential discrimination in healthcare, particularly among women and intersections therein, but also help equip patients and physicians with the tools they need. So I do that by creating trainings for physicians as well as patients, so that we can help them both interact with one another in ways that cultivate respect and trust and a shared understanding towards better health and wellness. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, drawing attention to the issues compels me to also think about what potential solutions could be, and to help people be, at least for physicians, the best physicians that they can be. And in working with physicians, I think a lot of them recognize and want to be better.
That's U of I Communications Professor Shari Thompson. She spoke with Maureen McKinney about a study looking into women's communication with healthcare providers. A Central Illinois attorney has been sanctioned after filing a brief written partially by artificial intelligence that cited several hallucinated or non-existent cases. As Ryan Denham reports, problematic anecdotes like this can obscure AI's promise in closing gaps when it comes to access to justice.
The case happened in the 4th District Appellate Court, which includes McLean County. Lawyer William Panicki of Springfield used AI to help write a brief for a case in which a woman was at risk of losing her parental rights. The brief referenced multiple non-existent cases, something only discovered when the appellate justices reviewed the case. It's believed to be one of the first known cases of an Illinois lawyer being punished for misusing AI.
I was careless and I was reckless when I did it.
That's Panicki talking to the justices during a hearing this summer.
I have no excuse, just explanation. At the point in time that I filed it, I was extremely busy and I made a mistake and was not thorough enough.
AI is disrupting many industries, but the stakes are unusually high in the courts, where a judge's ruling can take away someone's parental rights, livelihood, or freedom. The Illinois Supreme Court enacted a new rule on AI in January, generally permitting its use throughout Illinois courts, but reminding judges and lawyers that they are ultimately accountable for their own work. The High Court warned that AI could jeopardize due process or equal protection, and it called out misleading content that obscures truth-finding. That's what happened in the case before the 4th District Appellate Court. Panicki was appointed to that case last fall by the Sangamon County Circuit Court as the woman appealed the termination of her parental rights. That's when Panicki filed the brief, apparently using AI to write a draft of the brief and not reviewing what it had generated. Justice Catherine Zienoff told Panicki that it took a lot of extra work by the appellate court's research department and law clerks to unravel the mystery of the made-up cases.
And the extent of the work done, quite frankly, was significant and time-consuming.
Ultimately, Panicki was ordered to return $6,900 that he was paid to work on the case, plus a $1,000 fine, and flagging the case for the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. Separately, the justices upheld the trial court's ruling terminating the woman's parental rights. Panicki has been practicing law for 56 years. He told WGLT that he fell on his sword and plans to surrender his law license. The case seemed to unsettle the three presiding justices, who wrote in July that it was the first time they've addressed the use of AI in the preparation of legal filings. Justice James Kinect of Normal compared it to how someone feels after suffering a burglary at their home.
I've been a judge for 50 years, and now the sanctity of my service has been invaded by AI and by lawyers who have decided that perhaps AI is a shortcut or a useful tool, whichever way you look at it.
The case has made waves in Illinois legal circles. Here's Amelia Burgess, director of Illinois State University's Legal Studies Program.
We have a duty of candor to the court, and citing to cases that do not exist is inconsistent with our obligations as legal professionals and as attorneys. That is something that has always been true, though, that we have those obligations. We need to double-check the work, regardless of where it came from.
Burgess noted that the Illinois Supreme Court's AI rule is quite permissive and does not prohibit attorneys from using it. She says rules of professional conduct require attorneys to keep up with new technology.
It doesn't mean we have to be experts. It doesn't mean we have to use the technology. But if we do, we have to do so responsibly.
In announcing the new policy, the Illinois Supreme Court acknowledged the promise of potential efficiencies and improved access to justice. The access to justice gap often refers to civil cases. Criminal defendants have the right to a court-appointed attorney. Those in civil cases, such as divorce or family court, do not. Low-income Americans receive no or inadequate legal help for a staggering 92% of all civil legal problems that impacted them substantially. That's according to a Legal Services Corporation report. That leaves a lot of self-represented litigants. AI could help. Imagine an AI-powered app made available to renters, capable of answering questions about how to get your security deposit back from a landlord. What's the process? What are the timelines? What do I need to do before I move out? How do I evaluate if I'm really liable for these damages? That's a scenario described to me by Daniel Linna Jr., Senior Lecturer and Director of Law and Technology Initiatives at Northwestern. He served on the committee that helped craft the Supreme Court's policy on AI.
And now, with generative AI tools, with these conversational AI tools, we can create even better tools that are a little bit easier to create in a variety of ways, but that can really connect with people and meet them where they are to help them understand how the law applies to their situation.
Linna sees great potential for AI in improving the quality of legal work, not just making it more efficiently done. He says it could help judges process an onslaught of incoming evidence and briefs, or help attorneys more easily summarize hundreds of pages of deposition transcripts.
So it can help some of the areas where there's a lot of so-called grunt work that's being done, help make that a little bit easier to do and help get to better results, higher quality results doing that.
When used properly, Linus says there is a huge upside to AI.
Of course, we need to be measuring these hallucinations and the negatives, but the other side of the ledger is understanding the positive benefits that these tools are bringing across this whole ecosystem for lawyers, judges, and especially self-represented litigants.
Lena says there's an important distinction between consumer-grade AI tools like ChatGPT and AI-enabled proprietary tools built specifically for those working in the legal field, which would have access to all of the cases that are really out there. That would stop hallucinations. I'm Ryan Denham.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.